Joined on the stage by Joseph Longo, the chair of ASIC, John Lonsdale, the chair of APRA, and Michelle Bullock, the deputy governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Please welcome Joseph, John and Michelle as they make their way to the stage. Great to have you all here. We've got covered so much already. Let's dive deep into some of these issues. Joe, we are seeing mounting economic and inflationary pressures. The Treasurer described these as complicated, volatile times. So from ASIC's perspective, what do you see as some of the key priorities for regulation in these current uncertain economic times?
Well, I think some of the key themes have already come out this morning, and it's hard not to start with digitisation and the growing expectations of technology and digitisation for our economy. The Treasurer talked about payment systems today. But in terms of uncertain economic times, it's not just the uncertainty of what's happening economically, but it's also the uncertainty of the risk and the promise that these new technologies bring. So from a regulatory perspective, for example, ASIC is thinking, for example, about the implications of AI for the delivery of products and services. I'm still quite taken by the interest in crypto in this country. In the report that Peter King highlighted a moment ago, it really struck me to go to the new products and services involving a change of provider. 9% went to crypto, which was after, I made a note of it, after crypto came mortgages, personal loans and personal retirement funds. So 9% of Australians, or people who responded to that survey, were changing providers over a crypto issue, a crypto product. So that's very interesting to ASIC. And the only other thing I would say is there's a lot of expectations around sustainable finance and climate risk disclosure. And one of the concerns ASIC has is, frankly, complacency, that not getting ready in a timely manner. And secondly, there's a lot happening in our economy, and as the Treasurer said, a very ambitious agenda. So from a regulatory perspective, it's ensuring that we have a right prioritisation of those things, and that we encourage the banks and everyone in our economy to adapt and prioritise accordingly.
Just on crypto, Joe, are you a Bitcoin, Ether or Dogecoin type of guy yourself?
I think I've made it very clear publicly that I'm not. think that's been confirmed many times. That's right.
Michelle, the RBA, there's been no shortage of commentary, especially in the last 24 hours, on the use of monetary policy to curb inflation. Mm-hmm. From your vantage point, how's that all going at the moment?
That's a difficult question. The Governor gave a speech on this morning, which some of you might have caught up with. We are seeing some signs that increases in interest rates are starting to slow the economy. The challenge for us is that inflation is remaining stubbornly high, and it's remaining stubbornly high in the services area in particular. But this isn't... we're not alone here. This is a problem internationally. We're observing, I think, that the risks to inflation are remaining on the upside at the moment. And that's the challenge. So we really are trying very hard to bring inflation back to target in a reasonable period of time without foregoing all the gains in employment we've had. But it's very challenging when we've got very sticky inflation.
John, these recent monetary policy decisions and the associated commentary have placed greater scrutiny on the serviceability buffer. Have there been any thoughts about adjusting either higher or lower, or in a Goldilocks sense are we sort of just right on the servability?
So, Adam, good morning.
Good morning, John, sorry. And now on the serviceability, though.
Great. So we're constantly looking at the macroprudential settings, but I think the short answer is, as I sit here before you, 3% is the right number. We see continued uncertainty ahead. So we've got a global economy with some weakness in it. Domestically, we're seeing growth come off. We've got inflation in the system. There's still the possibility for further interest rate rises. cost of living, all these issues can affect serviceability. And so when you think about the serviceability buffer, that's what it's about. It's just not about interest rates, it's about serviceability. So we do see uncertainty in the system. So 3%, as I sit here, is the right number. Now, if the facts change, we can change too, and it's very fluid. The one other thing I'd add is that banks, of course, if they see a good borrower, maybe they might not pass the serviceability test, but maybe they are a good borrower, they've got a good track record, they can actually write the loan as an exception, and we will put out some guidance on that very shortly.
When it comes to some of those overseas uncertainties, obviously SVB we've heard about already, the difficulties at Credit Suisse. John, do you think that particular crisis has passed, or is there still some risk present?
Well, I think if you look at SVB and Credit Suisse, you could argue, well, that bit's passed, but there's a lot of risk still as we look out. So, as I mentioned, global economy weakness, particularly in Europe and the US. We've got rates still going up there, inflation. I talked about the domestic side. So there are certainly risks there. The good news for Australia is that we have a very sound, stable and resilient financial system. We've got, if you look at the prudential metrics, capital is unquestionably strong. Our banks are very liquid, well-funded. We've worked very hard on credit standards to lift those. They are all very strong. The regulatory frameworks that we've got, again, we are Basel super equivalent. So I think people can be very confident that we've got a very sound, stable system. But we're not complacent either. So there are some lessons that we can learn over the last few months, and we, together with the other regulators at the FSB, at Basel, are looking very closely at some of those. And domestically, the Council of Financial Regulators meets tomorrow, in fact, and these are live issues that we'll be talking about.
We heard with SVB Peter King just share his thoughts. He described it as banking 101. What went wrong there? What's your take? What was the lesson learned about what happened in that instance and overseas? And Michelle, I'd like to get your thoughts as well.
So I think there's a few. I mean, Peter talked about speed. That would be number one, I think. So when you look at SVB and you look at what the Fed said, there's about $40 billion of deposits left on day one and forecasts another 100 on day two. So that's about 85% of the deposits in 2 days. So that is incredibly fast. And so I think there's a real lesson there for us, for the banks, to really think about the nature of deposits. Are they in fact sticky? How we regulate those? I think there's a basket of issues there. There's some broader regulatory issues, I think, that again go to liquidity. Are we measuring, looking at the right things? I think there's some issues around hybrids, which goes to more the Credit Suisse example. The underwriting of the system, so the guarantee schemes, the use of those, the trade-offs with moral hazard, I think is a live issue. And the proportionality with which we regulate and the complexity interface, so have we got that right? And the last lesson that I think is a really salient one for regulators, the Fed report on lessons not only highlighted regulation, but it actually highlighted supervision too. And so when you look at SVB, they had significant risk governance issues, they had liquidity issues, and they were actually identified a few years earlier, but for whatever reason, regulatory action was delayed. So in Australia's case, we've updated our supervisory stance, we've got a constructively tough enforcement attitude, and so when we see something wrong, we might write a letter, but we're going to stop writing letters, we'll take action. And so that's what we've got to do more of that. It's a very, really timely reminder, I think.
I'll come to you in a second, Joe, on the whole regulation issues that come into this and stuff. What did you think, Michelle, when we see what's happened in something like SVB, should the Australian industry be scared and trepidatious, or should we be comforted, not in a schadenfreude sense, but that, you know, those sort of things are distinctly less likely to happen here?
I think I'd concur with everything John said, and I absolutely agree that the Australian system, particularly the interest rate risk in the banking book, I think has turned out to be, everyone highlights it. You go to international meetings and everyone says, wow, you had interest rate risk in the banking book capital requirements. Very, very important. I'd add two other things to what John said. The first is that we used to think of systemically important institutions. Actually, even really tiny institutions can be systemically important. And that's effectively what happened. The Fed declared SVB, now it was big, but it wasn't massive. It declared that certain institutions had effectively become systemically important. So I think we've probably got to broaden the way we think about systemic issues and what is systemically important and what isn't.
Has the bar for too big to fail fallen significantly?
I don't know if it's fallen significantly, but it does mean that the regulators have to think, and this comes to my second point, in fact, the Reserve Bank is a liquidity provider, if you like. It's the lender of last resort, but we lend to solvent institutions. And I think the speed with which this happened demonstrates that the regulators have to have a much better idea very quickly. We're not going to have a weekend anymore to solve these problems. We're not going to be able to put things off to a Friday and then spend weekend working on it. It's going to probably happen quicker than that. And we're going to have a much better idea about how we work with APRA, for example, on what is a solvent institution, should we be lending to that institution. So these are all things I think that mean the regulators have to rethink our frameworks a little bit as well.
What do you think, Joe? Some commentators are saying there's a need for greater regulatory collaboration, greater cooperation. What are some of the issues that you're working together with in this space, and what do you take from those overseas experiences?
Well, I can't think of a single problem or issue that we've discussed today that doesn't involve collaboration. I think that's the first point. And I generalise that principle across our society, that the big problems we're facing require us to work together. And I think that Trevor talked about the engagement with the ABA and among the regulators, that collaboration is continuous. The other thing about collaboration is that I think we're dealing more and more with greater and greater amounts of complexity and data and digitisation, and part of collaboration is we don't want to be duplicating our efforts, and so because that leads to cost and other issues. So another feature of collaboration is actually navigating the complexity so that we don't duplicate among ourselves what we're asking for. The other element of collaboration, there are just so many examples. Scams have come up this morning. Crypto came up this morning, sending money off to digital currency exchanges offshore. But the example that is very much on my mind at the moment is climate risk disclosure. Mm-hmm. We're very close to international standards being finalised by the International Sustainability Standards Board. And that's coming our way. The government's indicated and ASIC has supported mandatory disclosure. But there's a massive amount of work involved in rolling that out. And again, that'll involve collaboration, not just among the regulators, but with industry, the Australian Chief Company Directors, with the banks. So I think collaboration really is, if we're serious about solving big problems, then collaboration lies at the heart of that.
We'll get to the climate risk thing in a moment. And in an internationally connected financial system, that collaboration, of course, isn't just domestically. Michelle said there are examples where people overseas look at us and go, wow,
yeah,
you've got that.
That's right.
Do we need to do more to get consistency internationally?
Well, I think that the concept of consistency is related to the idea of duplication as well. And we will come to climate risk disclosure, but that's a good example of where we all want consistency. Nobody wants to be, whether they're liquidity standards or prudential standards or risk disclosure standards, these standards are very complex to administer. The data required and the science underlying them is very complex to administer. It's in everybody's interest that it's as much as practicable that they're consistent and they take into account different sizes of economies and companies. But I know at ASIC our international engagement continues to be very robust. So I'll be away next week. The IOSCO is having its AGM. One of its key agenda items will be going over the IWSB's efforts. But I can't think of a single important topic, and Michelle and John have just talked about the issues in the US where there isn't real-time collaboration and discussion going on of our international peers.
John, it's good that there are areas where we can pat ourselves on the back and say the rest of the world look towards us and go, that's best practice. What are some areas where you see other things around the world and think, I'd love it if we could catch up there? Where are areas in the regulation, consistency, et cetera, where we could up our game?
Well, I think it's just being cognizant and learning lessons of others. And, you know, whether you're talking about capital, liquidity, operational risk, I think is a big one. You know, cyber, data, I think really evolving areas, and technology is the other big one as well. So, I mean, all of those areas, I think we can look to others to see what lessons there are and make sure our regulations are as robust as they can be.
When it comes to our own backyard, the recent review of the RBA, touched on by the Treasurer this morning, made a number of recommendations. Michelle, what's the impact of the recommendations on the CFR, the Council of Financial Regulators?
I think the review basically endorsed the Council of Financial Regulators as being something which is an essential part of the framework, really, of our management of financial stability and so on in this country. The recommendations, though, I think went to perhaps formalising things a little more. So things like restructuring the MOUs and the charter to make it clearer that this isn't a passive group. It's supposed to be a proactive group, looking at where gaps in regulation might be, looking at risks, those sorts of things. Also, a lot more formality between APRA and the Reserve Bank in terms of the Reserve Bank's financial stability mandate and APRA's financial stability mandate. So the Monetary Policy Board, for example, advising the CFR and APRA formally about where they think monetary policy might be impacting financial stability, and mechanisms, more formal mechanisms, for how APRA and the Reserve Bank coordinate on macroprudential policy, because that's often the way we think about it. If monetary policy has financial stability implications, then it might be that macroprudential has to pick up some tools to address those. So I think they're the main sorts of things, and I see that actually as an endorsement of the CFR and strengthening its hand.
I see you nodding there, John. What's your takeaway from what was found in the RBA review about macropru and APRA's approach to maybe working closer with the CFR?
So we welcome the recommendations on APRA and macroprudential. We put out a framework, I think it'd be 2 years ago now, that really set out how we think about macroprudential, the objectives, the scenarios, the tools and how we might use them. So the review actually looked at that, noted it, made no recommendations on that. So in terms of how we and what we're doing, I think that's an endorsement. We'll keep doing that. I think, as Michelle said, that the big area where they honed in on was really the collaboration and cooperation between APRA and the Reserve Bank. There's a very close relationship between the organisations, but I think it is fair to say that it is more informal than when you look at other overseas jurisdictions. So I think it's a good test for us to say, actually, can we add a bit more formality around that? Can we be a bit more transparent around that, updating the MOUs, the advice? And I think all of that is really good. So we're going to lean into that and do that together.
The theme for this couple of days is time of transition. And when we heard the Treasurer speak, one area that was really in the spotlights was the payment system in general. What are the Reserve's bank priorities, do you think, when it comes to payment system regulation and evolution, Michelle?
So many priorities. I think the couple of main things at the moment. I think the payment system regulation at the moment, the framework, is really out of date. When I started in payments in 1998, payments basically were made up of people who were paying and people who were receiving, and then the bank for the person who was receiving and the bank for the person who was paying. And they were banks. They weren't anyone else. They were banks. That system now is just so completely different. There are people, firms, doing all sorts of chunks of the payments chain. So the current payment system framework, regulation framework, isn't really fit for purpose. So the priorities are really to get that framework updated, which the Treasurer has announced a consultation on. The strategic priorities for the payment system are also really important, and it's, I think, really important that the government is buying into this, because for some things that we are going to be facing into here, for example, the cheque system, the potential closure of the cheque system, Another one we're going to be facing into is the decline of cash and what that implies. We really need the government to be leaning into these issues, as well as the Reserve Bank having responsibility for trying to deal with them. So if I had to say what some of my priorities were, there'd be some of the things on the legacy side, which is how we're handling decline of cheques and cash. But on the other side, we've got big priorities in terms of the future of the payment system. How do we handle things like stable coins, which currently probably are not regulated? How do we handle things like cryptocurrencies? What do we do with central bank digital currencies? So I think there's a whole set of priorities which are looking at the future of payments. And you know, John used the term leaning in. The regulators have got to move with this, because if we don't, then things will move quickly without us.
Joe, on payments and on cheques, I'm old school. I love a cheque. When someone wins Powerball, will they still have a big novelty cheque with $100 million written on it? Can we still at least do that?
I think we can still look forward to those images. Just want to make sure the 100 million goes where it's supposed to go, I think, is the key critical point there.
But it is fascinating and far-reaching changes to a very central system we discussed this morning. Are you happy to see that on the agenda?
Absolutely. I think we all have an interest in productivity, in embracing technology, in embracing the use of data. But lest we forget, we don't have much of a choice here. We were talking about global developments and developments outside of Australia. And I think the word ecosystem has been used several times. We have to do this. We don't have a choice. The choice we do have is how quickly we move, what the solutions are, what sort of transition time we give ourselves. Michelle mentioned CHESS replacement. I mean, that's just such a fundamental part of our infrastructure in Australia. Some of you may have noticed the first special report was published a few days ago, where the ASX published its report on its current CHESS readiness and the current integrity and robustness of CHESS. There are two more special reports to come about the future. But that's an excellent example of where we had world-class infrastructure, but it's under pressure now and it has to be replaced. And I think Michelle also alluded to the need for competition and clearing and settlement. We have market infrastructure reforms coming. So the other word that comes to my mind as a regulator is ambition. That we have a very full agenda here. We're trying to deal with the ASX. We've got climate risk disclosure. There's all the points Michelle was making. We have crypto coming, where there are other law reforms that are imminent and are yet to be enacted. So that's a big challenge for all of us, to absorb all of that change and to make sure that the benefits of it, the reasons we're doing it, are actually happen, materialise.
Yes, Michelle, please.
Could I just add something on that? I think the payment system used to be the plumbing. No one was interested in it. It was just there. It's actually risen to prominence now, and it's a really important part of the economic ecosystem. There's a payments ecosystem, but it's part of the economy. And we're after competition to lower the cost of payments. That's what we want, but what's increasingly become obvious is that the safety and resilience of payments is really important as well. So we've got this dual issue now. We've been concentrating for so long on trying to get competition in payments and lower the cost of payments in the economy. But at the same time now, we're going to have to start focusing on safety and resilience. So that's going to be a challenge.
Yeah, you absolutely read my mind, because they seem to be the two sort of philosophical drivers, didn't they? There's the efficiency, the increased dividend to consumer, speed of the system, modernisation. But also a big part of what the Treasurer was saying was strengthening the system. One thing on the agenda there to you, John, APRA's letter on multi-factor authentication mentioned possibly reviewing CPS 234. For anyone in the room who's not up to date on that, I mean, I obviously know what CPS 234 is, but hypothetically, if I had no idea what that was, what is it? And what types of things do you think need to be looked at on the strengthening of cybersecurity standards?
Well, that's a great standard. It's one of 50 that APRA have, and it's a standard that deals with cyber, so it's very important. So cyber resilience, data, operational resilience, big strategic priority for APRA, and it's something that we have been pushing into for a number of years now. We're expecting entities really to be testing their systems, make sure they've got the controls on this right, thinking about scenarios, things that could go wrong on data, like basic stuff. Know the data that you've got. Know where it is. Know what's important. And what we're encouraging entities to do a bit more now is actually question whether they actually need some of it. And so, sadly, it's not really an if, but it's a when there's an attack, actually making sure that entities can continue to do the functions that they need to do, critical things to support their customers and support the community. So that's what we're pushing into. That's what we want. MFA, like, we put out some guidance on what we expect there. 234, we're doing something on that standard that we're not doing with any of the other 50, Adam, that we've got, and that is we're requiring an independent audit by every regulated entity against that standard. And so that is pretty intrusive, and some of the results are coming through, and I think it's fair to say there's room for improvement. So boards have got to lean in more, and I meet a lot of boards. There isn't a board that I meet that isn't aware of these issues, but because the risk is constantly evolving, boards and management have actually got to constantly evolve with the risk as well. Controls have got to be better updated, and actually thinking about third party, fourth party, fifth party safety, I think, is a really big issue, as well as data. So CPS 230, another number, another standard will come out. That's going to be a key one that's going to strengthen operational resilience. It'll improve business continuity, but most importantly, it's going to push into regulation for material service providers. And so we want to see that happen. And that hopefully, and I'm sure it will, strengthen the system that we've got.
It was Robert Mueller in a previous incarnation. It was at the FBI, and he had that great quote, "There are only two types of companies, those who've been hacked and those who are yet to be hacked." It's such a volatile, threat-filled environment at the moment. It's understandably front of mind. The other thing, shifting gears a little bit, we heard about this morning, climate transition. We'll be discussing it over the next couple of days. And we've heard for so long businesses and other players just crying out for certainty and a map forward. Michelle, how's the RBA viewing the implications of climate change? How's the bank preparing for them?
Yeah. So I think our focus, I'm going to let John and Joe speak for them, but our focus is really twofold, I think. One is on the potential implications for for the potential implications for monetary policy of potential issues here. Some of the things we're concerned about are potential supply shocks. So, for example, extreme weather events. What do these sorts of things do to inflation? What does that mean for our monetary policy thinking and framework? And the second thing is the transition, the investment that's going to be required, what that's going to mean for the Australian economy, how do we as the central bank navigate that, and what does it mean for financial stability? I know John will have more specific thoughts on that, but we do need to think about the impact of the physical and the transition risks on insurers and banks in particular, but more broadly through the financial system, and whether or not I think the focus here really is on making sure that they're aware of the risks. Scenario analysis is becoming increasingly important. It's used internationally. We're using it here. So these are the things that we're focusing on in terms of climate.
I'll come to you in a second, John. Joe, where do you see this? Because, you know, across industry, insurance has been seeing this for ages. Science has been seeing this for ages. Some industries have. Others are really dragging their heels on what have been told to be sensible timetables reform. Where do you see this?
I see this as the biggest change in a generation in terms of our approach to disclosure and our approach to investment. So sustainable finance is rewriting our whole approach. I think the key points from my perspective are, while we're going through this transition, there's a real greenwashing issue. We talked about investment scams earlier. But across superannuation, insurance, every form of investment activity and consumer activity, there's a real issue about greenwashing, and we don't want consumers and investors misled. There's a big capital raising issue here. One of the themes in our discussions so far this morning is international alignment and being part of that ecosystem and having consistent standards. Well, part of the point of that is we are a net importer of capital. So if we'd expect people to invest in Australia and in our companies, there needs to be a consistent taxonomy, a consistent approach to disclosure. So the stakes are really, really high. The only other point I'd make for this morning's purposes is that the scale of the complexity of this transition is huge. And so for the bigger end of town, I'll call them the ASX 100, the state of readiness is actually not too bad. I mean, I get a lot of feedback that there's still a lot of resources go into it. The area that I'm more worried about is the smaller end of town, the smaller businesses, everybody else, because the investment required, well, one, to ascertain what the standards are, we're close, but there's an upskilling issue within our economy among accountants, lawyers, sort of upskilling everyone who has to apply these standards. When they need help, you know, there's a massive education and facilitation aspect to that. And then there's a question of scalability, that whatever standards we end up with can work through the economy. And I know this is something I really want to stress, the expectations of governance in Australia are just going to keep going up. So we've heard John and Michelle talk about it. In the end, entities, companies, banks, superannuation trustees are all run by people. They're called directors, generally speaking. So my expectations, ASIC's expectations of governance are just going to increase. We're talking about a very sophisticated set of expectations, and that's the other key to this, high standards of governance.
Even the challenge of arriving on a set language and understanding of definitions of what certain things mean, and you've got your greenwashing, and also the big one now is greenhushing.
Yes.
And greenhushing is organisations doing things but not mentioning them yet for fear that they'll be judged the wrong way because there's such uncertainty and confusion.
Yeah, that's an emerging issue, but I think that the I'm with the group that says disclose, talk about what you're doing. I think greenhushing is not a good thing to the extent it exists. In my mind, the word I would use, it's a failure to engage. And by keeping your head down for that reason, you're not really engaging with consumers, investors, the economy.
Yeah. John, the Treasurer covered a lot this morning. There was a brief mention of climate risk being factored into APRA work. He didn't go into it in tremendous detail, but did your ears prick up when you heard that phrase? Where do you see the land there?
Well, that's been a big focus of our work for some time, yeah. Adam. So we talked about liquidity risk, we talked about operational risk, credit risk. This is another form of risk. And what we're saying to entities is you need to be aware of that. So we're not telling entities what they should and shouldn't do, where they should lend and not lend. But what we're saying is you need to be aware of it, you need to factor it into your decisions, and we want to see that. And so we've had a climate vulnerability assessment. So we've looked at a few entities and run a couple of scenarios, and there's really interesting sort of results out of that. Well, actually, climate risk does affect the balance sheets of regulated entities, and it affects some areas more than others. It affects some industries more than others. So, you know, when you're going about your business, you need to be aware of that. The taxonomy, I think, is really important, so we've got to be able to measure this. And, you know, we're engaged with not just domestically but international regulators on, you know, this broader work. So it's not just an Australia issue, it's a global issue. And the transition, like, critically important. I mean, the final thing I'd say is it links directly to insurance affordability. So you mentioned insurance before. They're not separate things. Like, it actually links directly to it, and that is something that we are very interested in.
It's all about managing risk. I'm going to finish by taking a massive risk and just swing down a panel with a closing question to you all, completely cold off the bat. We're talking so much over the next couple of days about challenge and opportunity. The Treasurer spoke of this big decade ahead of us. So I'd love you each, just 15, 20 seconds each, just give us one challenge that's front of mind for you, but also one uplifting opportunity. It can be banking, it could be the economy in general, but one challenge and one opportunity that are both really top of your thinking at the moment? I'll start with you, Michelle.
Gee, thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
So many. I'd say the big challenge for me at the moment is thinking about AI and the potential implications of that for the work that we're doing at the bank. It's not only about the payment system. I think it's more generally about the whole cyber risks thing. It's a big challenge. The opportunity, actually, I think, is actually AI too. And the reason being for that I wonder if as regulators, we can harness some of this. It can help us do our jobs better. But we do need the frameworks to get on top of it, and that's so why I think the challenge and the opportunity.
Fantastic. John, one challenge, one opportunity.
So I think when I look at APRA's mandate and what the Council of Financial Regulators are doing, safety of the system is just paramount. So thinking about how we can continue to keep the system safe when some things kind of appear constant, but other things are changing in nature. And I think Michelle's exactly right. I mean, AI technology, I would say, when I think about the financial system inquiry and where we kind of were in 2014 to now, so much has changed, and technology is the one thing that I would say we've got to be aware of how that links to the safety, and I think that is an opportunity as well.
You're in a great spot there, Joe, because you've had a little bit longer than the rest of the panel to think about it, but there's a chance they've cherry-picked and taken the things you were going to say. I'm backing you in here.
I'm going to be shameless.
Fire away.
I'm going to be totally shameless. I'm going to echo what Michelle said. We're talking about both sides of the same coin. So the big challenge, and this is something that ASIC's working on right now very intensely, is how these new technologies, we'll call them AI for now, they've exploded onto the scene, how they will manifest themselves in new forms of misconduct, in new forms of harm and for investors and consumers, and frankly, new challenges for us to investigate because we've all heard of the black box, and the underlying all of this are algorithms. Well, someone has to explain how they work, how the variables interrelate to one another. So that's a huge challenge. It's happening right now in various sectors. But, of course, therein also lies the opportunity. And I think here we don't have much of a choice. I think I've made this point a moment ago. The technologies, the data, the AI, we live in an interconnected world with very high community expectations around service delivery. Humble subject of getting a driver's license or paying a bill. These basic things, society's expectations that those things will happen safely, quickly, and very inexpensively, there's the opportunity, but there's the challenge as well.
And it is why this is such a fascinating time of transition, our theme over the next
right.
couple of days. Please, thanks so much for their contribution this morning. Michelle Bullock, John Lonsdale and Joe Longo, thank you so much, the three of you.
Thank you.
We're going to take our first break now.